I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. What can a parent do to reach an autistic child, to create some path through the barrier of autism spectrum disorder that might somehow lead to greater understanding of that child's mind and soul? That challenge is facing more and more families in the U.S. The National Center for Health Statistics estimates that one out of every 50 school-age kids has the condition. Behind those statistics, though, are the day-to-day stories of families coping with the often crushing challenge of autism spectrum disorder. One such family is the Mills family of Kalamazoo. Bruce Mills is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College, and he's the father of an autistic son, 21-year-old Jacob. Bruce's memoir of his family's journey is called An Archaeology of Yearning. Cindy recently spoke with Bruce about his book.
Why did you use an archaeological excavation as the framework for telling your family's story and Jacob's story?
Arriving at that idea actually was when the book took clear shape. I realized I wanted to try to understand the journey we were having with Jacob. And it was a journey that couldn't be told in something really simple. And when I thought of archaeology, I thought you have to first have something surface.
Mm-hmm.
Something comes to you. But there's a breadth and depth to understanding what that may be. So with the simple stories that I might remember with Jacob, it became more than narrating what happened. It was, well, how do I understand that in a context that has some breadth and depth, including other people's stories of their experiences with autism?
And you, as I read your book, it seems that even though it's telling us the story of Jacob and his autism, it really is more a story of your entire family, the communication amongst yourselves, and your journey with autism, you and your wife Mary, your daughter Sarah, and Jacob together.
Yes, I think that's important. It's a family story, my story, because I'm telling it, it's my angle on the story. But just in relationship to my son, my daughter's experience, for instance, it was important for me to have a whole section focusing solely on my daughter's experiences with autism in addition to my own, because she's going to be with my son longer than what my wife and I will be with my son.
That is, I'm sure, a burden that never goes away once a parent realizes that they have a child who is special needs and you know that you're going to be gone, and then what?
Yeah, and why I told the story, why I wanted to tell the story too, is a move from burden to something else, something that could be understood as being beautiful, something understood as getting beyond what is hard to address. It certainly is hard when having someone in the intimate space of your home who has a cognitive disability and trying to bridge that difference. That's a challenge. But if that was the only narrative of the story, then we've all lost. So it was how to wrap language around my son's experience, my experience with my son, my daughter's experience, in a way that, yes, we recognize the challenge, but that's not the story. Again, it's that archaeological dig. There's a greater yearning, a greater desire to connect out there. How do I capture that in this memoir? Let me tell you a story.
Yeah.
When my son was younger, he wouldn't hug us. We couldn't hug him. The sensory effect of that meant he moved away. So we weren't, in the language we expected of connection, we weren't getting it. And that can be a despairing thing for a parent, mm-hmm. especially for a child. But my son would back into us. He'd climb on top of me, and I'd play. In other words, there's another way in which you can understand what intimacy is, what love is. If I got stuck in what I needed, I would lose my son.
Wow.
But it doesn't have to be the way in which I needed it.
And you have to learn that. You have to learn what that new direction is.
Yeah, you have to learn it. And there's a part in the book where I talk about one of the hardest things is when you start a journey, you have to understand you may go into it and you may not be the same person when you come out. Mm. That can be a frightening thing. So I had to give up, and people, I think, have to give up a way in which they understand and process the world if you're going to have a connection with any kind of difference, but certainly with a cognitive difference where my son is, again, processing the world in a way that's different the way in which I might process the world.
And speaking of the beginning of a journey, I'd like to ask you to read us an excerpt from your book. And this is when you took Jacob in to be assessed by a team of experts just before he turned three. But before you read it, what had been happening that prompted you to want to have your son evaluated?
One of the most dramatic things that happened, he lost language. So he had acquired 18 to 24 words around the time in which you have language acquisition, a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then over the next year, he stopped using language. And then he started doing a lot of repetitive kind of play, lining up toys. I'm a teacher, as you said, at Kalamazoo yes. College, and I'd have students over, and he'd put chairs in a row, and he'd have them sit in the chairs as if they're an audience. So the play had a ritualistic repetition to it that was endearing, but seemed limiting. And so we had a sense then that something developmentally was unusual. In the winter prior to his third birthday, Mary and I had Jacob assessed by a speech therapist, a social worker, a psychologist, and an occupational therapist at Croydon. I remember watching him go through the physical tests and table play with a sense of pride as Mary joined the psychologist behind the one-way mirror in an adjoining room. I sat just off his shoulder, encouraging him, following him from toy to toy. I had to fight the urge to offer a running narrative of my son's seemingly special behaviors. Jacob likes to arrange magnetic letters like movie credits. He has great balance. He lines up toys for hours. After the formal testing, as we all got ready to leave, Jacob noticed a mirror standing against the wall. He was fascinated with his image in it. He danced and walked back and forth in front of the tall length of glass. The act seemed so childlike that I enjoyed the play of it until I noticed the two observers exchange glances. 2 weeks later, the psychologist on the assessment team met with us at our home. She indicated that Jacob had been diagnosed as autistic. Calmly and gently, she reviewed the report, underscoring why his behaviors indicated autism. She especially noted the language deficits and the tendency to lose words. She recommended some readings, suggesting that when we were ready, we could review the materials that discuss the long-term possibilities. She said that autism was not curable. It was a lifelong condition. She noted that because Jacob appeared to be so high-functioning, he might especially benefit from early and intensive educational interventions to build vocabulary and learn social skills. When she left, Mary and I sat at the table, glancing at the materials before us. We did not want to say goodbye to the Jacob we had imagined forward in time, the brother who would accompany his sister to the same schools, who would converse with her about teachers they might have shared. In our mind's eye, we caught glimpses of this unimagined child when he grew into awkward manhood, and then we wept for him and for ourselves. We had no story for this moment and this place.
That's Bruce Mills, professor of English at Kalamazoo College, reading from his memoir, An Archaeology of Yearning, the story of his family's journey with his son Jacob's autism. And Bruce, that moment has basically, as you say, taken the life that every parent envisions when a baby is born. So the life you had envisioned for Jacob, it's blown up. So how do you point yourself in a new direction when, as you write, we had no story for this moment in this place? Where do you start?
Well, I think for me it took some time. It wasn't that I didn't embrace Jacob for who he was or who he is. But, yeah, like you said, I didn't. We have the stories of when we were growing up and how we experienced youth. So not having those images of what it means to develop meant that I had to go looking. And one thing I did as someone who's a curious reader and someone who teaches is I went and I read about other people's experiences. I also joined the Autism Society and was involved. So it was important for me to hear how people, how parents mm-hmm. experienced their life with autism.
Talk about your circle of family and friends. How did Jacob's diagnosis affect the way they regarded your son?
I think we were very fortunate because I think sometimes there can be a falling away of friends. And in part, that's not anyone's fault. It's that early years with my son meant it was kind of isolating. We couldn't go out because it was difficult for him to go out given the sensory overload. And so we lost touch. So I think one of the things that was important for us is that friends who allow Jacob to be Jacob, allowed a meltdown to happen early on in the early years, and we're willing to listen to our repetitions, our endless stories about what was happening, good and bad. I think the other thing that's been important to us is Kalamazoo community has been tremendously supportive in its resources, school, teachers, psychologists, and the Autism Society there.
Tell us about Jacob's autism as he was growing up, and particularly what it meant in his day-to-day life, because it's incredibly clear from your book that Disney movies and other cartoons and drawing were an anchor to his world.
Yeah, the drawing, that helped us get out. We could go to a restaurant for 20 minutes if Jacob could bring his drawing materials. And then we could make it 30 minutes and 45 minutes because he was able to focus on the drawing, and we were able to focus on the drawing. We usually went at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon when they're just opening up. There weren't too many people there.
Yeah.
So, and this is another way. You can tell the story differently. You can tell, oh, it's very limiting, and it was at first. But you can also say Jacob guided us to the way in which we could participate in the world with him. So the early drawings, one of them was really a wonderful story, I think, for Jacob's sake, is that early on he was having trouble. He was asking us to draw something. It was the coloring of the Walt Disney Productions lettering. And we'd be coloring it, and he'd have meltdowns. And finally we realized, once he slowed us down, that he wanted a certain marker color over a certain segment of the Walt Disney Productions. And it we realized that he was having us drawing the color check at the beginning of videos as it passed, from right to left, left to right.
Okay.
And that can seem a small thing, but it stopped the meltdowns. But it also meant that image, which was so important to him, we now understood. We had a connection. And I think the idea of yearning that comes out in the book is that we had a connection to his yearning, to what he values. And then, again, we could share that.
I'd like to turn to your daughter, Sarah, because as I was reading the book, my thoughts kept turning a lot to her. She's a little older than Jacob.
Yes.
And the excerpt I'd like you to read, this is when you and Sarah had carefully planned a library outing with Jacob. You packed all the right drawings, the right pencils for him, planned to photograph the stuffed storybook characters at the library so everybody's happy, you and Jacob and Sarah, and then you get to the library and it is closed.
At first, Jacob just wept, letting his shoulders and back hunch forward, much like the crying poses of his animated characters. But quite suddenly, he screamed, ran toward the glass windows, doors, and strengthened by his anger, nearly forced them open. Sarah stepped forward to try to comfort Jacob, but I warned her back. As we looked on, he began to scratch his face and neck, leaving streaks of red beneath the tender lines of both jaws. For the next 10 minutes or so, we coaxed him foot by foot toward and into the van. Once in the back seat, however, he flung himself down and began to kick the windows. I yelled and reached back, grabbing at his shirt and arm. And then he went after Sarah. For a moment, she shrunk back, but then she started hitting him and crying and yelling, "I hate you! I hate you!" Finally, we opened the door and let his fury back outside. On the sidewalk, Jacob kept lunging toward me, his hands intent upon scratching my face or arms. In the refuge of the van, Sarah called Mary on the cell phone, and in 10 minutes, 45 minutes from the start of his outburst, she pulled up and took Jacob home. His anger now subsiding, he began to sob. "Jacob was so sad," he said. "Jacob was so sad. Jacob was so sad." My daughter held her own kind of sorrow, and she holds it still. This sorrow has no ritual of completion, no baptism or anointing, no confirmation, no rows of chairs and cheering, no dawn or dusk in which to confess or bear witness. Who will know that in this one hour she held her brother's hand and felt her arms ache to comfort his desperate body, felt her voice tighten and curse, felt her fists against Jacob's chest and back, felt guilt and love and the yearning to begin anew. I want you to know what no one can know, that the wind caught Sarah's hair, held it off her face for just a moment as she sat next to me on the sidewalk, that she let her small fingers touch the blood on my forearms. I want you to imagine the many things that we leave unspoken, the memories that we must hold in faith because we do not as yet discern their meanings. And I want you to know that Sarah is still reaching out to me and that we do not yet understand the loss instilled in us and the tenacious love that wounds with so much caring.
Bruce, it would be so easy to understand if Sarah had grown up and wanted to put a lot of distance between herself and her brother. What's their relationship like today?
It's a good one. What does that mean? I think it means that at this stage in her life, Sarah has a greater understanding of what Jacob yearns for, what he desires, and his own limitations, just like I think Jacob has a sense of ours. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a tenderness that comes in the kind of relationship that Sarah has with Jacob. The difficulty early on was, in many respects, Sarah had to be a mini-parent. And our demands of Sarah, because she had to be excessively good, meant that she had greater burdens in that way. And so some of the things she lamented growing up was that when she went over to friends' houses and she played with her siblings, she recognized she didn't have that relationship with Jacob. And that was hard. But there are other stories again.
Yes.
And I think now she understands the nature of the relationship she can have, that when Jacob sees her, he will sometimes jump on her and hug her and put his nose in her face and have one of his big laughing alerts. Mm-hmm. And that's closeness.
That's Jacob's expression of closeness.
And Jacob, we're finding he misses Sarah and he's expressing it more verbally now. So it's a different place than what it was, but that's, again, one of the things that for siblings, it can be difficult.
And actually any family's journey.
Yes.
Whether autism is a component of the journey or not.
And that's important because we have to connect across our differences in some way. The difference I focus on in the book is autism. But in fact, if we have connections, it takes work. Any family has to engage in that work.
The book is An Archaeology of Yearning by Bruce Mills, a memoir of their family's journey with their son, Jacob, and his autism. Bruce is a professor of English at Kalamazoo College. It was a pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks again for having me.